And I'm going to leave everybody unmuted, so please kind of mute yourself if you're not talking. This is the Hamnet Practice. It is 8:02, and this is 6:28:17. Terry can't be with us tonight, unfortunately, so I'm going to have to fill in for her. Now, she's been going through the American Radio Relay League Ham Radio License Manual. And she's just about up to how do you power up your ham rig. And I'm going to have some general comments first. And then we'll go into studying the manual for taking the exam. Now, we're going to consider power supplies. How do you power your ham rig tonight? And there's three different types of systems that we're going to worry about. The first system is your large base station, and that can be anywhere up to 1,500 watts for a ham license, and it is license dependent. I think if you have just the entry level license, it's much less than that. Those devices are normally AC powered. You won't find 1,500 watt rigs running on battery power unless the AC line is down. Now, you can, to get 1,800 watts, you can take a mobile rig or even a little handheld rig and run it through a power amplifier. For example, if you had a little Bofang and you put it through a linear power amp with 20 dB of gain, you could come up with 800 watts, which is a lot. For AC-powered stations, normally the antenna is going to be either a large dipole so you can operate in the HF rig, or maybe a tower, 60-70-foot tower with a Yagi or other type of antenna on top. Now, the next group of radios that we're going to consider are the smaller size base stations. These things are physically maybe a foot by foot by 4 inches high, and they're going to operate at anywhere up to about 150 watts. Now, those are small enough, they can be used in an automobile. And so all of those are generally powered by battery power, either car battery, golf cart battery, something of that nature. And then we're going to talk a little bit about handheld units. Handy talkies, like our Bofang, they operate at maximum of probably 10 watts, and they're generally battery-powered, small battery, nothing like a car battery, or with an AC adapter. Now, since the large units are all AC-powered, we're not going to worry about that. You plug it in the wall. You watch the electric meter go around, and you pay the bill at the end of the month, and everybody's happy. When we get into the portable rigs, the up to 150-watt rigs, either a base station or for automobile use, and normally if you're using this for a base station, it will still have to be powered either by a power supply or by a battery. It will not come with an AC plug. You plug in the wall and it'll go. Now, these devices are going to take a DC power of about 13.8 volts and anywhere from 25 to 30 amps. 13.8 volts sounds like an odd number. And the reason it's an odd number is because that's about what the voltage regulator on your automobile regulates to. So these are made to run off a car battery. So if you have a base station, you can bring that car battery in the house. And when you're not using the ham rig, you can put it on charge, charge it up. Just make sure you have air circulation because it gives off hydrogen when it charges. And you can run your rig that way. And the advantage of doing that over a AC to DC supply is that there's less noise coming out of the battery. The battery does not generate noise. The other thing you can do is you can buy a 110-volt AC to DC converter. Now, they come in two varieties. One is like the one I have sitting here. It's a little black box, about a foot by foot by 2 inches, 3 inches high. Just has outlets on the back and a power switch on the front. And it generates 12 or 13.8 volts at 23 amps continuous. Now, if you go buy a power supply, you want to make sure that you check to make sure the rating is continuous, not with a duty cycle of, say, 60, 70, or 80%. Now, these devices operate by chopping up an AC wave from the power line and beating it down in level through a transformer, chopping it up at a high frequency so that it's easy to filter. In the old days, we didn't have all of these nice electronic circuits, and so we brute forced everything. We just had large transformers and a diode bridge of some sort, and then a bunch of big capacitors and inductors to get ourselves a nice smooth DC outlet. When you used to go buy a hi-fi set, everybody had a hi-fi when I was a kid, you go into the store, you pick it up, you buy the one that's the heaviest. It's got the biggest transformer on there, the biggest power supply, therefore the largest power capability. Now, there's two types of those little AC to DC converters, one like the bare bones one I have. Had I thought about it more, since I like to experiment, I would have bought the second variety. And it has a set of meters on it. It has a voltmeter and a current meter. And it has adjustable DC output voltage and a cigarette lighter socket so that you can plug things in, like your GPS, for example, if you wanted to, or a charger for your cell phone, that sort of thing. And they don't cost that much more, and I think I would recommend anybody that's going to go that route, go get the one that has the meters on the front. You can do a lot more things with it. Now, I'm going to start in on section 5.3 in the manual, which is power supplies and batteries. And it makes the point initially that power supplies are nothing. They just sit there and maybe hum a little bit or get warm. But without a good power supply, your ham rig is not going to operate properly. There are a number of factors that go into what that supply should be capable of doing. Yeah. Now, one of the things that can be a problem is that the voltage output changes with the amount of output current. Normally, the higher the current you're drawing out of it, the lower the input voltage goes. And that's not good. If it goes too far, it can begin to overheat and then damage your rig, and you don't want to do that. So there is a regulation factor on it. So when you buy your power supply, check the regulation on it. See how much droop you get on the voltage and make sure that it's within spec for your particular receiver. Now, most of these new ones are pretty good. The regulated supplies have regulation of a few percent, so they might drop if it's 15 volts, maybe 3, 4, 5%. And that should not be enough to give you problems. They are a good source of power for your ham radio because they prevent voltage fluctuations from affecting the functions on the radio's sensitive circuits. Now, as you all know, right away in the morning and in rush hour and evening, the line voltage drops, the line frequency goes down a little bit because everybody on Earth is using power to do things. And with a regulated supply like this, that should not create any fluctuation in the DC output. Now, the current rating of that supply must be at least as much as the sum of the maximum current needs of everything you're going to hook into it. It may be just your ham rig. You may have other stuff that you want to run off it as well. But make sure, before you add things to it, that it has enough capability or your regulation is going to start to decrease and you'll start drooping more when you're talking. A single power supply can be shared between two or more pieces of equipment if it has a high enough current capacity. Now, mobile installations in your vehicle, they have some special requirements for power supply and safety. I don't know how many of you have experimented with a car battery, but when I was a kid and there weren't a lot of welders around, if you got a couple heavy leads, a ground clamp, an electrode holder, you could weld with a car battery straight out. No transformer, nothing needed. Which means that if you short that battery with the wiring in your car, it's going to fry it almost instantly. So be careful. Make sure that you don't put anything across the terminals that would short the battery. They can do damage to your radio equipment if you short them, and they can start fires because it'll burn the wiring insulation and do a lot of expensive damage to your car. If it happens and you're not there, it can burn your car up. It can be like some of these Fords that you drive in the garage and you come back later and the garage is burned to the ground. You don't want that. Some general guidelines are: fuse both the positive and negative leads of your radio near the power connection. Connect the radio's negative lead to the battery terminal or where the ground lead is connected to the vehicle body. Anytime you run through a piece of metal, floorboards, whatever, use grommets or sleeves to protect the wiring from chafing or rubbing on exposed metal. Because normally if you drill a hole, those edges are sharp, and in time they will wear through the insulation. Don't assume all metal on your car is connected to battery ground. Vehicle bodies often use a mix of plastic and metal, and on older vehicles sometimes the ground strap to different things like the exhaust and so on kind of corrodes away when you don't have a good ground. Now, vehicle power wiring often carries a significant amount of noise that can affect your radio's operation. Now, one of those things is alternator whine. I'm sure you've all heard it. It's a whine. If you have it tuned to an AM station, that's pretty weak, and you'll hear it. If you speed up the engine a little bit, you'll hear that whine increase in frequency. And if you slow it down, it'll go right back down again in frequency. It's caused by noise on the DC power system inside of your own vehicle. It can occur and be transmitted through your ham rig, and on the other end of the line, people listening to you will hear a high-pitched whine on the transmitted audio. If they get practice, they might be able to tell about how fast you're going by the whine and the frequency of the whine. It can be removed by a DC power filter at your radio. Now, I have one in this area when I go work out in the morning. I'll be driving along and listening to an AM station. It'll start with a whine, and it can start anywhere in the frequency band. It can be very high, and it'll, as I go along, it'll just get lower and lower and lower and lower and lower in frequency until it hits bottom. Then it'll start going up and 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 up, and then I'm away, and it's gone. And that might take place over 3-4 miles. So somebody in that area is transmitting something they're not supposed to. And when I come back, I'll pick it up again, although it won't start out at the same frequency and it won't end up at the same frequency, but it'll still be there. And it totally messes up your radio. Now, I don't know who's doing it, whether it's somebody with a ham rig over there or the power company's playing games or what's happening. Now, in the event of a power outage, things like generators and inverters can be very, very useful. I'm not sure if you're all familiar with inverters. They're a device that takes DC and converts it to the AC. It's the opposite of the power supply we just talked about. And it operates on much the same principle. It takes a low voltage, chops it up, runs it through a transformer to get it up high enough so that you can form it into a nice sine wave at the 110 volt 60 cycle frequency and voltage level. Generators, they generally speak of as being AC, and that's true for your car alternator, which is AC. It's a three-phase AC generator, and it has 6 diodes in it, which convert it to a DC level with ripple, and then it has some filtering to get rid of the ripple, some of the ripple, not very much. In the old days, we just had generators on cars. I have two tractors that are old enough to have a generator on. They do not have any electronic circuit regulators on them. They do not have any diodes in them. They just have a little mechanical vibrator set up to regulate the voltage out of them. So if we have an EMP problem, those two generators will probably still generate exactly like they did about 1959 and 1947. So if you have a real old tractor around that works, you might consider setting it up to power your ham ring in an emergency. Okay, from the book, for portable and disaster or public service operation, AC power from the utility grid may not be available. In situations like this, generators and inverters are used. A generator turns mechanical energy from an engine into electrical AC or DC power. An inverter does the opposite, turns DC power into AC power. The AC power from either can be used to run a regular AC power supply or charge batteries. Now, one thing about both your generators and your inverters, they can be pretty dirty filtering-wise. They can have all kinds of transients on them, which your system does not like. So if you're buying an inverter, you might try and buy one that has a pure sine wave output. If they don't, they'll give you a percent distortion that occurs because of the way they generate the AC on it. You're always better to go to a pure sine wave inverter, but they cost more money, probably 30, 40, 50% more. These generators and inverters are rated in watts. That's the amount of power they can supply while still maintaining the output voltage within a specified range. Now, if you've ever used a generator and you start loading that sucker down, you hear that little governor open up and that motor starts to grunt, and when it does, the voltage on it and the output comes down. So if you're running it hard enough to load the engine, you should have bought a bigger generator. Make sure that since the regulation on generators is not good, buy one with a big enough capacity so that it's not loaded 100%, or you're going to find that the voltage is dropping off all the time and you're not going to have the results you need. When you do have a decreased DC voltage on your transmitter, it can start generating all sorts of harmonics. And these rattle around your system. They can go out and go with the signal you're transmitting to someone else when you're talking to them, so it can mess up what they receive and it can mess up what you're transmitting. So it's to be avoided. We already talked about the fact that you want a nice undistorted sine wave on your AC generator or inverter. And voltage regulation is important, as we just mentioned. Now, batteries. Batteries supply DC power in place of power supplies for portable radios, emergency power, and other uses. Now, they're made up of simple little one-cell devices, and they just keep stacking them up till they get to the voltage that they want. Now, for example, in a 9-volt alkaline battery, it's actually 6 1.5-volt cells. An automobile's 12-volt battery is made of 6 cells. So lead-acid batteries have about 2 volts per cell. Alkaline batteries have about 1.5 volts per cell. Yeah. And there's many different types of batteries. Some are chargeable, some are not. For example, we have the little alkaline batteries that are the cheapest kind that we get, AA's, AAA's. They're fully charged voltage about 1.5 volts. And if you look at their energy rating, and they rate them in amp hours. So if you have a 1 amp hour battery, if you have a device that runs at 1.5 volts and it takes 1 amp, it'll run for 1 hour before the battery is totaled. And those are not rechargeable. So when they're done, they're done. AAA battery has about 1.1 amp hour capacity. A AA has about 2.6 to 3.2 amp hours. Days have gone by. Years ago, they used a lot of carbon zinc batteries. They needed energy on your telephone line to ring the ringer on your telephone. And so they had these old carbon zinc batteries. They're about 2 inches in diameter and maybe 6 to 8 inches tall. And they're pretty crummy and cheap, and they only had about 0.6 amp hours, but those things lasted for years and years and years. I've seen places where they've gone into buildings where they had some still in the wall, and it might be 10 years later, and they're still good. Another type is your NiCads, nickel cadmiums. They're rechargeable. They have AA's or running at 1.2 volts. They have about 0.7 amp hours capability. The improvement on them in some ways was the metal hydrate. And they're rechargeable, 1.2 volters, and they'll run 1.5 to 2.2 amp hours. Then you get into the bigger alkaline batteries. Remember the C-cell? That used to be the cheap little poor flashlight battery. That's a volt and a half alkaline, and it runs at about 7.5 amp hours. So because of its size, it has much more capability than a AA like you would expect. The D size, that was the big flashlight battery. The cops carried about 6 cells, D cells in their battery, so they could swack people with them. And you probably had a 2-cell that ran a short period of time. D cells are a volt and a half alkaline, and they have about 14 amp hours. So now we're getting up there pretty good. Then you can get into the 9-volt metal hydrides, NiCads and stuff. Now, if you want to just go out and get yourself a lead-acid battery, car battery, they used to be pretty cheap. They're getting up towards $100 for a good one now. And they run about 12.8 volts nominally. And they're just fine for running your ham rig. If you want to go to a little better battery, you can buy a golf cart battery, they're called. They're a deep cycle battery, which means that you can run that battery right down to nothing practically and then charge it up fully and then run it right down to nothing. And it doesn't hurt them, and they have a limited number of cycles they can go through, but it's far in excess of what a car battery is. Car batteries are made to run steadily charged, full capacity. And so if you take a car battery and you run it down to 8, 9 volts from 12.6, it's not going to last as long as a golf cart battery. Now, a golf cart battery started maybe $120 to $200 now, but they have a higher capacity, and they are a deep cycle battery. And what you can do if you're anticipating the grid going down or your electricity disappearing for some reason, you can pick up a little 2 or 3 panel solar charger that'll charge about 45 watts. And if you get a little charge controller, you can just stick that across your battery, whether it is an automotive or golf cart type, and just keep it topped off with that. If you've been using your ham rig heavily at high power, it'll take a little bit longer to recharge, but it will sit there and sputter along until it gets it fully charged, and then it'll turn off automatically. It's kind of an easy way to go. It requires no outside input. It makes you independent of what the generous power company does to you. Okay, now, some general guides for using a battery, and these are kind of common sense things. To get the most energy from a battery, limit the amount of current drawn from it. A low discharge rate keeps the battery cool inside and minimizes the losses due to the battery's internal resistance. Now, the harder you run a battery, the more you draw current out of it, the warmer it gets, and the more loss you get, and the harder on the battery it is, which makes sense. To maximize the battery life and capacity, store them in a cool, dry place. They talk about refrigerating them, but I don't know too many people that do that, unless maybe a little AA's and AAA cells. You might toss them in the fridge to keep them cool. Don't freeze them, but keep them cool. Moisture allows charge to leak slowly between the battery's external terminals. And if you notice on batteries left in anything too long, they start getting crud around the ends of the batteries on the terminals and green goop and so on, and gradually dissolve the plating off of the terminals and that sort of thing. So regularly inspect your batteries for damage and leakage. And if you have a little tester voltmeter, you can check to see what the voltage is. These little alkalines run about 1.5 volts, and the lithiums as well, but the lithiums are fairly flat in discharge characteristics. The voltage stays right up until they get maybe down to 1.2, 1.3 volts, and then they just drop off and nothing flat. When you're recharging your batteries, be sure to use a charger designed for that particular type of battery. Don't stuff an alkaline battery into any charger because they aren't made to be charged. If you have lithium batteries, get the proper charger for them. It has to be the right voltage and max current capability. Each different battery chemistry and size requires a certain method of charging. Too much recharging current may damage the battery. Too little may keep it from reaching a full charge. Now, I'm sure you're all familiar with the, I think it's the Samsung phones, or the batteries blow up and burn the thing up and all that. Be careful. I'm not sure if you can get, I think you can get chargers for these little lithium batteries rechargeable, but I'm not sure. Be careful if you charge them. Storage batteries such as deep cycle marine or RV batteries are often used as an emergency power source in place of a power supply offering from AC power. Now, my little setup, I've got 6 of these monster golf cart batteries, and I've got a 5-kilowatt inverter that runs off them. And I've got a 12-kilowatt AC generator, so I can set it up so that when the power is off, like it was last winter for a couple, 3 days, I can start up the generator, and I have a smaller one as well. And if the draw on that generator exceeds its capability, the inverter will kick in and provide the extra current. Maybe you're starting a big motor or something, your well pump, for example, something like that. And the inverter will kick in and supply the necessary current so everything will start and run normally. If you run these motors and stuff at real low voltage, because your generator is too small, when they're turning on, it'll eventually fry the contacts on the motor and burn the motor out. So you don't want to do that. Storage batteries are often left connected to a charger to make sure that they're fully charged with a small current, called a trickle or flow charger. And you can buy those little things for, I don't know, $5-$10 from Harbor Freight and places like that for 12-volt batteries. Just plug them in the wall and leave them plugged on. And it'll keep your battery topped up. Now, when you're charging either the lead-acid types, the golf cart type, or the car battery type, make sure you've got good air circulation in the area, because you can have an explosion from the hydrogen that's released. They do have special caps if your battery has to happens to have the right design on top that will keep the hydrogen from being released into the air, and you can use them in a far less ventilated space. The battery types that I have, those caps don't fit, so you have to use ventilation. Be careful you don't short circuit stuff, because when you got a bunch of batteries hooked up there, you've got tremendous energy there. And if you should happen to short clear across them, mine are all paralleled up 12 volts, that's horrific. They're like 1,000 amp each at 6,000 amps. That's enough to just fry a wrench or something that gets across it and probably melt one of the terminals as well. When you're done with the battery, don't just throw it in the garbage. Now we're talking these little batteries, the alkalines and so on and so forth. Materials in them are mildly toxic, and so check with your local hardware store. There's places like Best Buy that will take lithiums and that sort of thing. So recycle them if you can. Well, are there any questions at this point? Well, since everybody spoke at once, I didn't understand a word you said, so I'll move rapidly along. Our little Bofangs, they have two basic batteries that come with them, the standard and then the enhanced one. I think the enhanced one is 1,800 milliamp hour. The regular is like 1,000. You can also get a little AC adapter to use if you don't want to use your battery. You want to keep your batteries charged up. Just use the AC adapter when you're around the house and use your rechargeables when you go out. Again, they come in all the varieties that we talked about for AAAs, AAs, and so on. You got NiCads, you got nickel metal hydride, lithium ion, and so on. You will not find lead acid batteries for the Bofang. They're just too big and heavy. They're not useful. It's a good idea to keep some disposable batteries. For example, if you've got a little transmitter that uses maybe A cells or one of the little handhelds, keep a bunch in around just in case you happen to deplete your rechargeable battery. You can stick those things in and get through until you get to a charger and charge your other batteries. Okay, that's about all that I want to discuss on batteries and powering up any of your either base station, portable rig, or handheld. Are there any questions before we move on? The next topic is radio frequency interference. Okay, I'm now on section 5.4 in the ARRL ham radio license manual. And if you have the manual, after you go through a section like this, it will tell you where to go to get the questions that go with that section so that you can make sure that you understood everything in the section before you move on to the next one. Now, what is RFI? What is that? Well, it's radio frequency interference. And as you all know, we have a ton of things in our homes now that radiate RFI. Just the wiring in the wall, the radar range, radar oven, microwave, whatever you want to call it, probably your TV. Everything that you control anymore seems to have a wireless control. Our computers have a wireless router, so you've got RFI running around all over the place. I've got a Bose stereo setup, and the foolish thing has no manual controls on it at all. It's all wireless. I would never buy another one. In the middle of the night, occasionally, it will turn on if you've got some CDs in it. It will turn on and play at max volume till you go down and unplug it. It's a real attention getter. So RFI comes from everywhere. And I have a meter, trying to think of the name of it. And I can walk around and I can find every outlet in the house and I can find where every wire runs in the house. It's called Mr. Gauss, I believe. And just by holding it and going up and down the wall or crosswise in the wall, when it goes over a wire, if there's any current in that wire or something that's plugged into it, it's drawing a little current, you'll get the RFI energy from it, and Mr. Gauss will tell you how bad it is. So as more and more electronic devices and electrical appliances are put in use every day, as we just mentioned, we get radio frequency interference. And it can come either way. It can come from us, or it can come through our antenna to us. Either way we get it, it's undesirable, and we need to eliminate it. By the way, if you're a ham, and you're transmitting, and your neighbor starts having your voice appear on his TV and stuff, it would behoove you to go over and explain what's probably happening, and it's not really that he is doing anything wrong. It's just that the TV set front end was so poorly designed that it didn't discriminate against the frequencies that he happens to be transmitting at. And it would be a kind and good thing for you to go next door and and help him put a little filter on the front end of his TV signal, either on the cable or I guess not many people have antennas anymore, but I guess they coming through their dish could be too. Now, filters are an important part. Anyway, before I go to that, RFI, like I was talking about on my radio, car radio, on the AM channels, there is no way that you can filter that out. The only way you can get rid of it is to find out who's generating it and have them clean up their signal. Now, the FCC would probably be delighted to help you do that if you would like to get them in on the case. Now, filters are an important part of radio, and they are important in preventing and eliminating RFI. Filters are used to prevent both unwanted signals from being radiated in the first place from your transmitter and to keep unwanted signals from being received through your antenna system to your speaker. To select the correct type of filter, you have to know the nature of the incoming signals, interfering signals. And if you have the manual, it's on page 519. You'll see a setup with a typical low-pass and high-pass filtering setup. Okay, AC power line filters are low-pass filters that keep RF signals from passing into or out of equipment via the AC power connection. You know, there are people and there are systems that use the AC power line to send their signals. There are security systems, for example, where you can take the sensor and it can be anywhere as long as there's an AC line there. It could be out in the middle of a field, wherever, in your house, outside. And you plug this sensor into the AC line, and then you go up to your house or wherever you want to set up the detector, and you plug it into the same side of the 220-volt line, and it will send a signal when something appears there, and it will send it to the receiver. Now, I have one of those on my barn, so I can pick up cars coming up the driveway, and I have two large white cats that are big enough to set it off. So every time they walk past the foolish sensor, I know they're out running around. So be careful. Now, these low-pass filters, in other words, they pass energy only in the power frequency, 60 hertz. They reject all other frequencies. Now, there are also high-pass feed line filters, and you install them in the antenna end rather than in the 60-cycle low-frequency end, and those will reject interfering RF signals that are above and below your desired frequency range. Now, that can be a problem if you're using multiple frequencies but across the band, for example, the HF band. You'll have to have a separate one for each band that you operate in. RF chokes, or common mode filters made of ferrite material, are used to reduce RF signal. Okay. Now, they can be signals that are flowing on unshielded wires, such as speaker cables. They can be on AC power cords, telephone modular cords. They're also used to reduce the RF current flowing on the outside of shielded audio, microphone, and computer cables. So they're kind of handy little devices. Now, a device need not be a receiver to experience interference. Telephones, music players, touch-sensitive lamps, you know, and even probably the clap-clap, lamp on, lamp off, and other electronic devices can be affected by a strong RF signal. I found that my son used to have fun with the neighbors because I have a garage door opener. And he found out that one of the neighbors a couple miles down the road either had the same signal or my transmitter was a little bit noisy. And when he punched the button when he went by there, it opened a garage door, which was not nice of him. If RF signals can gain entry into an electronic device, components such as transistors, diodes, and ICs turn them into voltages and currents that affect the device's function. possibly upsetting its operation or distorting an audio signal. That's called direct detection. The symptoms of direct detection are thumps or pulses when a transmitter is keyed on and off. A garbled voice might be heard during an AM or single sideband transmission. Strong FM signals are usually detected as hum. And I'm sure you're all familiar with that 60-cycle hum. If you ever have a little handheld AM radio and you walk under a fluorescent light that's on, you get that nasty hum, or even some of them, the ballast is so bad on them that they'll sit there and vibrate so that it makes an audible sound at 60 cycles and drives you nuts. To eliminate RFI caused by direct detection, the RF signal must be prevented from entering the component. Direct detection is the most common form of interference for telephones, since they're rarely designed to reject RF signals. Low-pass RF filters connected at the telephone's input connector are the best way to reduce direct detection. Now, are there any questions? It's about time to shut down here. We're about out of time. Questions, comments, anything at all? Well, I can come to two conclusions, one or two. Either you're all asleep or you understood everything fully. So it's time to shut down the Hamnet for this evening. I enjoyed having you all on board. I hope you'll come back next week when Terry will be here to give you another good lesson on things that you need to learn to pass your ham license. Now, the HF ham bands have usable rings of coverage out about 700, 720 miles from your antenna. Some frequencies are good in daytime, some are good at nighttime. In order for us to have a usable long-range ham network, we need to have people that have HF rigs, and these are not the cheap Bofangs. These are the more expensive mobile stations like we talked about tonight, set up at intervals on the order of, say, 700 miles, crisscrossed across the country. It probably takes between 5 and 10 to cover the country with any sort of reliability in case we get into a problem where nothing works. With that in mind, you need to get a ham license so that you can practice and become familiar with and efficient with the modes of operation, the frequencies to use, the times to transmit, and all that sort of thing. It sounds simple, but when you get down to the nuts and bolts of it, it's quite complex, and you need to practice it. So I would encourage everybody here on the call to consider upgrading from a Bofang. If we can get at least 8 to 10 people scattered throughout the country, we have a pretty good chance of having a useful net and not having to rely on repeaters up and down the states that give pretty good coverage as long as they're up and operating. It'd be nice to be more independent than that. So with that thought, I am going to stop the recorder.